Hey, John, you mentioned Sleeper's website, and I've got a lot of people who missed it. Can you mention that again for me?
It's on AboveTopSecret.com, and Sleeper is a poster there, and he's got a blog. So you go to AboveTopSecret.com, get to Sleeper, and then go to his blog, and you'll read some of the most fascinating story you've ever read. Hey, Richard, I have a question. Can I ask you a question?
Of course.
Yeah. What do you think is the largest gas giant in the solar system?
NASA.
Okay, at least we agree on that.
A trick question, but you got it right, Richard. Okay, have you looked at those pictures?
Yeah, of course.
What do you think?
Well, there's some really interesting geometry.
Mr. Face on Mars, what do you think?
The name of the game is geometry. And frankly, John, I see more interesting things than you have highlighted. I mean, to the right of the blue thing, it looks like a crab to me, you know, with the two arms coming out. I see very rectilinear things that, you know, again, it's hard to tell because we don't have a scale. Do you know how big this picture is? How
many miles across? Yes. Lomonosov, I think, is 50 miles. We have the scale written down somewhere. But, of course, we left a lot of that. We didn't highlight much.
There's a lot of regular
stuff. Look at the obvious thing to the left there. You know, Ron Schmidt said, hey, should I highlight that? I said, no, why don't you just let them find that? I mean, there's so much stuff around
there. Well, there's a lot of very interesting regular things. I mean, that's what's really, you know, the kind of clincher. In a place, George, that has been smashed and battered by random impacts for billions and billions of years, which is the NASA, you know, view, you should not have regular geometric features that look like, I would say an airline terminal. All right? I mean, since we're not down there, we have no ground truth, we don't know what this stuff is. I very carefully try not labeling things except kind of like tongue-in-cheek because there's no way without ground truth of knowing whatever this stuff was used for until we get there, until we land.
Well, we could ask the guys that are there now when they come back.
If we can get them to tell us the truth. You know, I'm fascinated that you are talking to somebody who claims to have been there. I would demand a slightly higher level of proof, John. Well, how do you know he's not giving you a wonderful Shaggy Dog story?
Oh, we get some wonderful stories.
I'm sure. I do, too. I don't believe them unless they give me something I can check. And that's the key thing here. We've got to be able to check it. You were going to talk about the moon as being towed into orbit.
Yes. As a matter of fact, I was just going to ask you, Richard, what you think of John's theory. And then, well, let's have John elaborate on that first. Just
yeah,
for some new listeners, we get thousands every day. John, tell us about that.
Okay, Norm Berggren wrote a book called Ringmakers of Saturn. Norm's bona fides just are fantastic. I mean, he worked for 40 years for major, major aerospace companies. He was Lockheed 20 years. He's just a fantastic guy. He's 85 years old now. He got a hold of some Voyager pictures, and he was the one that showed us those big, huge vehicles in the rings of Saturn. Anyway, part of his theory is that the moon was placed in orbit in rotational lock. And this summer, when I was at the Bay Area UFO conference, I went to see him. He was at Stanford Hospital. He injured his shoulder. I drove over, picked up his wife, and took her over to see him. And I had an hour with him. It just fascinating. He's so alert, you know, and just really a great guy. And during the conversation, I said, Norm, where do you think that EMV, the electromagnetic vehicle that placed the moon in orbit around the Earth, where do you think it is now? He says, on the backside of the moon. Now, you have to understand that Norm Berggren was on the inside for many, many years. So if he says something like that, then you can be sure it's probably there. So when we started looking around Tsiolkovsky, the crater that looks like it has a little nice island in the Mare there, Beth in Florida started unmasking it, and there is what appears to be a huge EMV electromagnetic vehicle. And I think that's probably the one that towed the moon into orbit. Now, let me just read you. I asked Norm, would you email me a statement? And here's what he says. And also when he talks about the video, we're talking about the Apollo 17 video when they flew over Tsiolkovsky and they filmed it. At that time, and that video is on the, I think it's on on the internet, but I'm not sure. Anyway, here's what Norm Berggren says. Quote, the still images show the kind of illuminations one might expect of an EMV. Video, however, shows changing light variations well outside the highly illuminated area, suggesting that more is still going on than is evident in the stills. More work remains to find out how all of this fits together in the effort to try and answer specifically the what. We believe we have taken a step forward in calling attention to this very significant activity found on the moon. And that was written by Norm Berggren yesterday.
Huh. Well, Richard C.?
Richard, what do you think?
Well, all right, I'm coming at this from a little different perspective. I agree that the moon is not natural and it was towed into orbit.
You do agree with that?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I haven't published the data yet.
Why does it look all...
Because
tattered and smashed up.
Because it's a natural body that was...
Okay, maybe it was an asteroid or something huge like that.
Remember Arthur Clarke's third law? Any sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic.
Right.
If you have the level of technology that I think was operative in the solar system quite a while ago...
Well, so it's... But it's a you're saying it's a natural object towed in.
I think it was a natural object modified and towed into orbit, placed in orbit around the moon, around the Earth, to allow life on Earth to exist. In the hyperdimensional physics, which we, of course, don't have time to get into tonight, if the moon didn't exist, we wouldn't be here either.
And
Velikovsky life would not be here.
Velikovsky has numerous references of a long time ago when there was no moon.
Well, we're talking a long time ago there was no moon, yes. Now, the difference between Berggren and me is that, you know, when I look at an object on the surface, there is no way I can tell what it's used for. It's geometric. It doesn't belong. It's not natural by the criteria established by people like Sagan. Remember Sagan's great line? Intelligent life on Earth first manifests itself through the geometric regularity of its construction.
Mm-hmm.
That is a maxim that's useful anywhere, not just in the solar system, but anywhere across the galaxy and the universe. If you took a picture of a planet 500 light years away and somehow got it back here, I could look at it and, depending upon the resolution, tell you whether anybody had ever lived down there based on the geometry of the things we see in the image. That's the only remote sensing criteria we at the moment have to go on. So, you know, you look at this thing in Tsiolkovsky, and Berggren thinks it's an EM vehicle. I have no idea what that is.
The electromagnetic vehicle.
Yeah, but I know what it means, but I just don't know how he could possibly tell. He's looking at light and dark pixels in a picture. How can he tell what it's used for? It may be a geometric shape that's not natural. How does he know it's a vehicle? I have some more interesting supporting data in favor of the artificial toad moon hypothesis. Back when I was advisor to Cronkite, I met the head of the lunar seismometry experiment, who was at Columbia University. He was a PI. NASA had picked him to design the seismometers to listen for moonquakes.
Okay.
And we spent considerable time because it was one of the things that I figured we could make available to people that would kind of humanize the space program. What I wanted to do was to turn the seismometer readings into musical notes so that when we tuned in his instrument, instead of seeing squiggly lines on a piece of paper, which nobody could interpret except a scientist, we could actually hear the rumblings of the moonquakes in the moon. All right? So I got kind of close to him and his experiment, and I followed it during the entire mission. Well, when the first readings came back from the first seismometer put in place on Apollo 11, all hell broke loose. When they impacted the S-4B, which is one of the upper stages that sent them to the moon, vectored it into a crash on the moon rang like a bell for over an hour. And nothing on Earth seismically ever does that.
Well,
so
that makes it sound artificial, though.
Exactly. And in years later, I have figured out how this works technically by the numbers. Anyway, they put several more seismometers with the rest of the Apollo program down at the Apollo 12 site, the 14 site, the 15, 16, 17. In other words, we have a small network of seismometers. And by having a network and correlating the data, you can get a crude CAT scan of moonquakes going all the way down to the core. About 10, 11 years after the landings, they got enough data that this guy published a paper in Science, which I've got, showing two incredibly huge, definitely geometric, definitely symmetrical, definitely arc-shaped structures or masses or something buried, you know, a thousand miles beneath the surface of the moon down near the core, symmetrical about the Earth-Moon line. As soon as that data was published, NASA turned off all the seismometers, claiming they couldn't afford to keep them running. The cost to keep those seismometers running and get more data on the interior of the moon would have been about the cost of coffee money for NASA headquarters for a year.
Maybe they didn't shut them off, Richard.
Well, exactly. Maybe they just told us they did, but they've kept the data running.
Right.
The point is, I believe that what the scientists found on the seismometry data were the engines inside the moon, George. Two huge symmetrical masses inside the moon that were used to move the moon en masse by changing the inertia, by using gravitational warp effects to move it, not by rockets or EM effects, but through gravitational inertial changes, and that those engines are in the moon waiting to be investigated if we could find the way down to the core, which, of course, there has to be.
Interesting. Where do you think the moon came from, if it was towed there?
Okay, here's another piece of hard data. When Apollo 15 landed, they did a core tube. In fact, they had a big problem. David Scott, who was the lead astronaut, can be seen on those films pounding and pounding and pounding and trying to get that core tube first into the moon. It was much too resistant for a natural soil surface. And then he had a lot of trouble getting it out. It turned out to be something like 15 or 18 feet long, broken into sections and put in the lunar module, then brought back in the command module. When the scientists investigated the analysis of this core tube going from the top all the way down like 18 feet, it turned out that there was a very sharp break in the composition of the gases that were impinging on the lunar surface at about 1.5 to maybe 1 billion years ago. It almost looks like the moon orbited one kind of star that was evaporating gases like the corona.
Sure.
And then was brought here and then exposed to the sun's corona, which has a very different chemical composition. There's this incredible sharp break, which absolutely makes no sense unless the moon was moved from one environment to the other.
You agree with that, John?
I'm just glad I didn't have too much more to say.
And, of course, this data is in the NASA archives. Anybody can look at it, look it up online, and come to their own conclusions. The thing is that when you're trying to grapple in these very, very far-out areas, it takes more than one swallow to make a summer. It takes more than one piece of data to reach a conclusion. That's why I don't talk about a lot of this stuff until I've spent years looking at a variety of inputs, a variety of sources, a variety of papers, and try to synthesize a picture that will explain all the disparate evidence and then make a prediction or a set of predictions about what we should find next, if, in fact, the far-out theory is true.
Why, again, is the moon necessary for our existence?
Because in the hyperdimensional model, you require a large gate between three dimensions and hyperspace, and the bigger the mass orbiting faster, the more open the gate is and the more the energy comes through and allows living things to be here.
So without that, is it blocking?
Without that, you get bacteria. That's why there were nothing but bacteria, cyanobacteria on the Earth for billions and billions of years until the moon was brought here, which was roughly half a billion years ago.
Well, John Lehrer, you're not going to change your mind. You claim we're still mining there, right?
Oh, absolutely. Take it, you know, and the audience, our listeners, can just look at it and see for themselves. There's no doubt about it. Go to above.topsecret.com, pull up those Copernicus pictures, and just sit there and put them on your imager, and it's just fantastic to see all the stuff that is there. There's buildings, there's cranes. What's interesting is we call the smoking gun. There happened to be the Copernicus oblique pictures, lunar orbiter 2162H. There just happened to be a lunar orbiter 5155M that shows the identical picture but taken 2 years later, and it shows down, and you can see the same stuff there. You can see the cranes, you can see the buildings, everything, the vapor, or as Richard says, the glass is still there.
I think it's scattering off glass, and in terms of artificial sharp objects that are new, we don't know, John, how old they could be. They could be tens of thousands of years old and look like they were put there yesterday.
Why the public perception, then, that we're going to go back to the moon if we're already still there? Who wants to react to that? How about you first, John?
Well, they're trying to dovetail their operations now into what we're going to do, because eventually they're going to have to say, yes, you know, we're there mining the moon. They're going to have to come clean on this eventually.
So they want to kind of merge into that.
Yeah, they want to merge that.
You agree with that, Richard? Well, of course, you don't believe we're mining the moon.
Well, George, it's not about belief. It's about evidence. John is much more certain about this than I am. I am incredibly uncertain about a lot of things because what I see are ancient ruins. I see a few things that are much, much less ruined, and i.e. then newer. I don't know the time frame. I have no ground truth. I have no data that says when this stuff was done. I'm looking at meteor erosion rates. I'm looking at NASA papers that say that in X number of million years, you get this amount of degradation. That's how the INA story kind of came together. What I'm waiting for is the new missions and the politics converging, because I do agree on this. Because the world's technology has now caught up to us circa 1969,
mm-hmm.
and the Chinese are going, and the Indians are going, and the Japanese are going, and the Europeans are going, and the Russians are going, George Bush had to go back to the moon. Now, he can't admit that he's got this incredible super-secret space navy with anti-gravity that Gary McKinnon tripped over, and they're going to fry the poor guy for it. So he has to pretend that we have to reinvent Apollo. Apollo on steroids, as Griffin called it, and we go back to the moon with, you know, something stupid and primitive like rockets. But it's all, as John said, it's a con game. It's a face-saving procedure to try to bring these two ends of the paper together, and because people will not be there day by day by day, if in fact there is some mining going on, and I think it would be excavating for artifacts, there's going to be no way to say, wait a minute, you've been doing that for 20 years. They could claim it was 20 days. Who's to know?
Richard, you keep saying that we're there, and then you say we're not there. What is it?
It depends on what we're there for.
No. Are we there now?
I don't know. The honest answer is I don't know.
What do you think that Space Corps is doing?
I think they're going a lot farther than the moon.
Well, yes.
And I mean, look at Iapetus. Look at the stuff in the outer solar system.
They're going to all those places.
I think remember, you got to ask yourself, what's the point? You know, if we're so far ahead of everybody, if we have a lock on this technology, what are we doing out there? Well, that brings us to this, you know, the big question no one wants to talk about. Do we have enemies in space? Do we have bad guys that might not want us to leave the solar system? Do we need space defenses?
Well, if we don't, we're sure.
Is Iraq merely a chimera for a real conflict?
David.
Richard, if we don't have enemies, we'll certainly manufacture some.
Yeah, that's true. David Jacobs thinks we do have enemies up there.
Yes, and Steve, what's his name, says no.
Steve Troy says?
Stephen Greer. Yeah. So, I mean, you've got, again, a difference of honest opinion. I value David's opinion. I value Stephen's opinion. I don't know because I don't have ground truth. That's why I went into artifacts as opposed to UFOs. Because with the artifacts, if I get imagery and I use physics and light analysis and proper computer technology and I have multiple sources, multiple missions, multiple countries now, like the Mars Express versus, NASA's data. I mean, there's some astonishing Mars Express imagery of Sidonia, George, which, again, if looked at properly, confirms extraordinary things.
All right. Richard, got to run. I want to thank you. You're going to be at the Life Conscious Expo, the Conscious Life Expo.
February 9th. And we're going to knock people's socks off with absolutely amazing photographic evidence of stuff on the moon.
EnterpriseMission.com. I'll be back in a moment with John Lear, and we'll take your phone calls. Fascinating hour with you two. I'm George Norrie, back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM.
Find out more about tonight's guest. Log on to coasttocoastam.com.